Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. Does food production have to be for a profit? I question where profit fits into grocery and how markets are working. There are a lot of not-for-profit grocery stores right now and a lot of co-op models which are not really designed to produce large revenues. And in places where there are food deserts or lack of access, especially to fresh fruits and vegetables and meats and dairy, like, the impact on the community is so strong. Like, there's higher poverty, and there's, you know, cognitive delays, and there's obesity, and there's diabetes, and there's all these expenses. And if access to healthy foods gets rid of all that, then are those costs enough to justify the grocery store? And so, like, where does grocery fit in on that spectrum? And then I guess on the other side of it, the same thing is true with farming. Like, obviously, if it is a career and it's taking time, like, people need to make money. But we've talked a lot about how cheap can food get and how do producers make a business out of this and stay viable. And, like, you end up in this spectrum of, we really need this produce, so where do these people fit in? And we really need people to eat so that they, especially children, so that they can grow up and add to the mm-hmm. world, you know, the brain power of the world and solve these problems. And so, like, where does profit fit in? And it's interesting to see people like Alice, who does make some money, but largely is doing it to increase the access to her community. And then where Renee fits in on, he has time, he has interest, and really wants this for his family.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm hearing in your comments two things. One is, okay, are you describing in a way the whole government subsidy program that already exists? Is that kind of the concept that we're trying to practice? And then secondly, people like Renee and Alice, are they also subsidizing this whole thing with either their free time or some of their expenses? And then, yeah, it's really interesting, Michelle, you're laying on top of this, is food part of healthcare? And if we're talking about Medicare for all or universal healthcare, government socialized healthcare, where does the food and diet fit in there, huh? That's exciting.
Food as medicine is this huge growing topic. So there's definitely a conversation to be had there. And programs like, there are doctors that write prescriptions for fruits and vegetables, which then are, you know, provided at a lower cost. So there are places that that's happening for sure. And I would absolutely say that Renee and Alice are subsidizing the cost of food. You've argued in the past, when I asked probably the first summer of lockdown, with more home gardenings happening, does that take away from the small producers that are selling at local markets? And you argued that it wasn't, because as you start to consume fresh fruits and vegetables at home, you're more likely to and supplement what you're producing with local production, because you've now tasted that fresh carrot. So maybe they're not at odds, they complement each other. I don't know. And then, like, where is it a hobby and how much training do you need? I mean, little things like you've said, fertilizer really is important, has gone a huge way in making my garden productive. So we don't want everybody to make this a career and optimize it. Like, it should be, if it is a hobby, it should be enjoyable. If it is part of your budget, like, it should be not input intensive if you're willing to give time to supplement your family. But, like, how productive do we want small gardens to be? And then the same thing happens on the commercial side. A lot of the automation you've talked about is to improve outcomes and reduce costs, but how automated do they need to get? Do they need to be as integrated as the large producers? Does that change something?
Again, what you're describing is so interesting. When we had Alice on in a recent episode as a guest and her farming and life out in Western Kansas, her words are haunting me, Michelle, where she described traditional farming out in the Great Plains in terms of profitability. Did she say something like, all you're doing for your entire career is working for the bank and just to make payments on interest payments? So we connect some dots here. And I mean, some of our agronomic effort is nonprofit, and our farmers are simply maintaining and trying to exist. So yeah, there's a lot here to dig into. And with your economic background, boy, am I going to have fun in the future as we kind of explore this. Now, you've also kind of triggered an idea that came to mind. Let me keep probing on the home gardening. So we've talked about how in at least northern climates, it's only summer season, spring, summer, early fall. So at most half of the year, these home gardeners can produce produce. And then the rest of the year, we're expecting them to go to the vertical farms in the local agriculture. Okay, so if we have them interested in producing or eating fresh food all year long, now, what if we picture a residence in the future, and let's look at the basement. The basement could be a vertical farm environment. Now, instead of asking or requiring a homeowner now to learn how to vertical farm and lighting and everything, what if we then create a new do-it-for-me industry where someone else comes in once a week to kind of do the things that I do, and the produce is all growing there in the basement, and the homeowner can do as much as he or she wants, but doesn't have to worry about all that technical stuff. How cool would that be? Now we've got 12-month production, and you might have a hub on each cul-de-sac where one of the homes is really serious and interested in growing stuff for the whole street.
Yeah, I think that option is really cool. I sometimes question how much we want to decentralize it. And so where you got to at the end, where there's one house on the block that is doing it for everybody, I think is a good place. It made me think of in Spain, I think recently they were discussing this law that required basically restaurants to give you leftovers. And the idea was that it would reduce food waste. And so if everybody had the option to take home their food, they would eat more of it. And so my question then was, well, yes, they might eat more of it, but how many people really eat the leftovers? And then from there, the people that don't eat the leftovers, they are more likely to throw it out versus a restaurant could compost or sell it to a renewable energy source that is looking to collect food scraps. And so I kind of get to the same place with every house having its own indoor farm, where is the inefficiencies of all of these small units and all of these people more than if we just had one unit in each neighborhood or multi-story house. And yes. So it's a lot more decentralized than it is now, but maybe not on every single person. But I think that's where we want to play with. How do we get to this food system that's much more decentralized, but serves the people?
Yeah. So this is a fun exercise that you're bringing in the Alice's and Renee's of the world. And I enjoy participating in this level of the conversation. But I keep coming back to my commercial DNA.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking simultaneously, okay, a production center on a cul-de-sac, what is the model? What's the scale? How many cul-de-sacs could one professional farmer with, I don't know, half an acre of greenhouse, I don't, whatever the square footage is going to be, what is that model to, and then how many cul-de-sacs can that operation take care of?
Urban, more urban areas. I was recently given the stat that roughly 30% of urban, like New York City, urban areas are parking lots. And if we, you know, move away from everybody owning cars and more shared cars or more autonomous cars, then, or, you know, the pandemic changing cities, how much of that 30% that is just places to park cars and even more in the suburbs, how much of that could be repurposed for some kind of production? And again, to your question, what scale does it need to be? We talked with Zach from the University of Illinois about his urban farming, where he's working on with growers that are producing a couple hundred square feet or a fraction of an acre. And do we need to know how many people that feeds? Do we need to think in terms of farmers on how many farmers we need or how many acres it takes to support that person? It's sort of, in my mind, it's sort of a chicken and egg. Do we need to know what we need from the producer side first, or do we need to know what we need from the consumer side? And then how do we make them align, right? If you have a population that's very interested in, I don't know, eggplant or something, or long beans, something that, you know, might not, do you get that expertise? Where do you get that expertise from? Or do you just grow what people in the area are good at? What people want, I think, is really important and often overlooked. It might be a really good region for growing squash, but if people don't want squash, they want beans, then how do we align those?
Yeah. But let me go back a little bit on grocery and the concept of profitability. When you make that suggestion that perhaps a grocery store could be a nonprofit, are you assuming that the farmer, the producer, is also operating that way, or that would be traditional profit model?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are a bunch of nonprofit grocery stores. Like, that is something that exists. There are also a lot of nonprofit farms, and some of them that are connected. I have to say that I have been shocked and fascinated by the number of food banks or food kitchens or charities that have their own production, that have fields. I mean, even the two in Natick, the two by me, they both have decent sized gardens and raised beds so that they're producing all summer in order to supplement what they have. And the Boston area gleaners, who go into the fields at the end of the season and pick extra produce that was not going to be sold, and collect that for nonprofits for food access and distribution, they've actually bought land and a warehouse and now grow too. So I think both models already exist. And the question, I guess, is what is the impact, or what is, you know, how do we feel about that? Is that taking away from local producers that could be producing for profit? Mm-hmm. Is it a necessary piece? We've talked about donating in the past on farmers that decide that they've overproduced and they're going to donate, and whether that makes sense, or terminating those crops earlier. And then also in the sort of local piece of it, my thought is, if you have local production and you have local consumption, that the system will slowly build itself. You're going to need more people in the middle to sort it and cut it and move it. And like, those create jobs. And so that creates more money. And now you have more people that can afford to shop at the grocery store, and the grocery store that can buy more from the farm. And it becomes
When I was a teenager through junior high school, middle school today, we had the that old gender bias model of the girls would take home economics and the boys would take shop. And I think we've succeeded in blowing up that model so where it's gender neutral and we should have both genders in both topics. But I can see hearing your comments where, gee, wouldn't it be cool at some point in the future when early on in the education, middle school, high school, everyone takes a class on food and global food supply, home gardening. That should be fueled. You know, the teachers could be the small farmers if they buy into that.
Yeah. The question is, as our information expands, how do we prepare students? But I think that's part of the question. Are we preparing them for life, or are we preparing them to be educated? And are there trade-offs? Interesting place where when we became industrialized is when the work divided, where men went to town and women stayed home with the family and the garden or whatever. But prior to that, men worked in fields with children all the time, right? To teach them how to farm or how to take care. And so child care was much more an integrated part of the family, and we don't function that way. So it's kind of which skills that used to be handed down are not anymore, and where do we get them?
Well, those pre-industrial generations, again, I'll use non-gender specific, both the husband and wife, the man and the woman, everybody did everything because you had no choice. Everybody needed to pitch in. And so I think if the fulcrum here, the pivot point is industrialization that you're bringing into the picture, boy, I mean, it was good in so many aspects, but it also kind of collapsed some of this social structure that we enjoyed. Maybe I'll pull back what I said about gardening. Maybe what we need to teach our young people is healthy diets and healthy eating. And then that automatically cascades down to generating an interest in gardening and fresh food.
Absolutely. And my understanding is that actually needs to start in preschool and elementary school, yeah. That by the time you get to middle school, a lot of your habits are formed.
Good point.
And I think that a lot of that is access and knowledge, right? I think that a lot of consumers have this idea that everybody will choose a processed cookie over a fresh piece of fruit in terms of something sweet. And there is research that suggests that's not true, that that by just presenting people with the fruit, you do increase the amount. How do we get good tasting fruit and vegetables in front of children? And then the question is, how do we do it? I mean, obviously you don't want them thrown out. I'm thinking about myself now, and part of the garden that part of the reason I garden is exactly what we're talking about. I like doing it, but there is a rule in my house that you have to eat something from the garden every night, and you only have to have one bite, but it does increase exposure for sure. And as I mentioned earlier, we're starting camp now, and so there's this huge disruption, and most days my daughter does not eat lunch, and we have been told that that's perfectly normal. So when she started out eating the cookies the first week, and I knew she wasn't really eating the cucumbers and strawberries, but I made sure they were in there every day. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to waste new cucumbers if she wasn't going to eat them, but it was very important to me that they were physically in her lunchbox to signify that this was important. So I'd put them in for a couple days, and then they would, of course, turn to pickles, and I'd have to throw them out and start over. But now that we're a few weeks in and she's starting to find her balance again, the cucumbers and the strawberries were both eaten yesterday. And so, you know, the cookies are still there, and it's all about a balanced diet for sure, but it's that exposure. And so you obviously don't want the, you know, young kids to be given green beans that are not tasty at all, right? We want them to have the food that you and Renee and I discuss. So like, how do you do that? How do you teach that? And I don't know, maybe it is what you were saying earlier. It is more connections with farms. And how do you have farmers come and share their produce or visit farms? Or 2 summers ago, we had the, you know, the bee group from the local high school and the apiary on. Like, can we build that into the curriculum so it's not just shoving food at them at lunch, but it's kind of giving the story behind the food?
Absolutely. Yes. Check, check, check. And by the way, congratulations, Mom. That's a great rule. That's a great rule. Something from the garden every day. That's excellent. I love it. On the diet part, Michelle, for me, after 6 decades of my diet, I won't say unhealthy. I mean, grow up on a farm, fruits and vegetables were always a big part of my diet. My dad was a meat cutter, like your dad, in the meat industry. So we always had nice, you know, quality meats, but also grew up really high on carbohydrates. And after 6 decades of living that way, now that I've shifted gears and have a very much upside down diet compared to those 6 decades, if you told me before I started this personal journey that I would not, 3 years into it, that I would not be missing potato chips, that I would not be missing sugary soft drinks, I would have said, I'll probably cheat from now and again. I can't see myself giving up, you know, baked potatoes and rice and all that. But, you know, to kind of blow up the myth, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It feels so good, and my health has improved sufficiently that I don't miss them at all. And my wife and I are we're not fighting each other on this. And you know, my nickname for my dear wife has been, you're a carb girl, because ice cream and potatoes were real. She enjoyed them passionately. And she too now has pretty much put them in the rearview mirror. So if we can start early, as you're suggesting, and not have to go through those decades of unhealthy eating, if we can get there from the beginning with our youngsters, and rules like what you're establishing and ideas like I'm touting, to have replace a hard goods pantry with a small vertical farm off the kitchen, we're all pulling in the same direction.
Except, how do we get it to everyone? And whether it's people like Alice, where the community isn't able to get regular deliveries, so to have either doesn't have a grocery store, and therefore, or isn't big enough to get regular deliveries, Alice is filling in that gap herself. Or if you're closer or in an urban city where, it doesn't even have to be a city, but a more urban area where your grocery stores, quote unquote, are bodegas and convenience stores that don't stock fruits and vegetables, and the perishability of them makes the profit margin so tight, then those people can't make that choice. And I think that then leads us full circle. The problem with not just fresh fruits and vegetables, but dairy and meats, and even freshly baked breads, is they are perishable. And the perishable makes a huge impact on the profitability. And so it is hard to sell these items that immediately are decaying, and how can someone stay in business that needs to sell them quickly, right? And then it gets more complicated. Do people have time to cook them? And so, you know, what is the balance of things that have to be cooked versus snacking peppers and so forth? But I think that a really big challenge in all parts of the country, besides basically the most wealthy or wealthy suburbs, is these things are low profit items and therefore are harder to keep in stock. And when people don't have access to them, they're not going to eat them, or they're not going to learn that they want to eat them. And how do we do that? And the answer isn't to make them cheaper, because on the farmer's end, that's not really possible. And we've talked about more direct to consumer, but the advantage of direct to consumer right now is that consumers pay more than wholesalers. And with low income populations, they're not going to.
My PhD advisor in graduate school was a post-harvest physiologist. So his career was all about, his research was all about how to maintain freshness, how to hold on to it as long as we can through the chain of distribution. So you're bringing up an excellent point. If we are saying we'd like our agriculture system to be fresher, our food to be fresher, that's more expensive. And as you're describing on the backside of it, the wastefulness, holding on to things too long, what do you do with them when they expire? So this all intensifies the effort. So I think, and again, you and I are kind of saying the similar thing. If that's what we want, it cannot be cheap. It's impossible unless we were to go to your original thought of this episode. Is our food system, you know, like analogous to universal health care? But I think an overriding given, as locally grown food movement moves forward, Michelle, a given, like a foundational premise, is we need to improve freshness and availability.
Yes. I think the other thing that I've been thinking a lot about this season is on the other extreme of the freshness, that when you go to a grocery store, right, people complain that the fresh food doesn't taste like anything. And that's why they either have their gardens or they buy from their local farmers, because you get this taste. And taking that to an extreme, our backyard has some mulberry trees that are very old and we didn't plant. We found them a few times, but this year, like very early in the season, and there were tons of mulberries. And so like we ate some, and I sort of joked about it that these are clearly not bred for consumers, right? They are really hard to get the stems out. They tasted great, but they were not shelf stable at all. There is this middle ground of, we don't really want wild types of all these things, right? We do want some breeding. We do want some technology. We do want some shelf stable, but we don't want shelf stable at the expense of everything else. And so where is that middle that gives us enough time to sell or distribute or get to people the food, but isn't so focused on making every tomato perfectly round or every tomato bright red that you leave some taste and other attributes in there?
We've talked at length about shrinkage, and you know, I've been very vocal about my philosophy that I'd prefer to sell out rather than grow long. So perhaps part of this, the efficiency that would be required, so there's not a lot of waste if we want more freshness, Michelle, maybe it's simply first come, first serve, or in your economic view, we want to grow exactly the number of tomatoes that are demanded. And we know that that's nearly impossible. But I would still come down in this argument about freshness and controlling waste in that concept of, all right, just don't grow too much. Let the supply run out. You know, maybe on tomatoes, you're going to the grocery store as a farmer every other day or three times a week. So let there be nothing on the shelf when you come to resupply. And you're constantly adjusting your production, which you emailed me a week ago a wonderful question about how the local farmers and the grocers need to work together, and the grocers are not offering long-term upfront contracts because the farmers, we've covered this ground how many times, we need to make decisions in the fall what we're growing the next winter to buy supplies. So again, everything we talk about seems to be connected. You pull a thread and everything kind of, you know, pulls tighter together.
Yes, I am curious as to, as we move away from just in time or we're forced to in different places, will it allow enough planning for better contracting with farms? If instead of ordering in May, are in to ensure summer vegetables because the global supply chain is less of a known right now, will grocery stores or restaurants contract much earlier to make sure that they can get those products? And that is an opportunity for local producers. And or a lot of companies will purchase a, we could just use your 80-20 rule, right? They produce, they buy 80% of what they need off the global markets, but they never want to be without. And so they contract 20% locally and they know that it's going to be more expensive, but you know what? At least you know you have it when you need it. And so are these conversations, are these business models going to become more common across all sectors, but is an opportunity for local production or right size or building out some of the infrastructure to support all this?
There are times when you and I kind of flip our stereotypes, and we can pick on topics every now and then where I, the older one of the team, is the idealist, and you, the economist, can see reality, and you use words cynicism a little earlier in one of your comments. So what I'm seeing in an idealistic way to kind of answer your question, will the grocery store ever offer the farmer that type of lead time and consideration? My sense is that the demand, the market's going to force them to. If more of our consumers want freshness, as we're saying, if they want locally grown, if they want that grocery store to shift a little bit from 80-20 to 70-30, 65-35, then the grocer eventually is going to succumb because he or she wants that profit margin that they're making. This is pre-Michelle's model where the grocery store is a nonprofit until we get there. So I think that they will bend to the pressure if we can succeed in generating this locally grown demand. That's my idealism for today.
We talk a lot about how cheap does production have to be for farmers and how do they remain profitable, and they're completely essential. And then on the same side, the same thing happens with the grocery stores. Like, we want grocery stores. They have a huge public benefit. Obviously, markets, you know, are successful and would be great if they could support themselves. But if that isn't possible, I don't know. I don't want to come across as the person that's just saying all food should be free throughout the whole system. Because I don't actually think that's sustainable. But it's interesting to see how these different models interact with each other. And I do think that there are a lot of factors that are pushing on how does money and food fit into our current society? And so whether it's having access to food and grocery stores, being able to pay farmers enough that they can continue to farm, or more recently, conversations that are pitting solar panels against agriculture production land, or during the pandemic, people wanting to get out of cities or get more land, just driving up to farmhouses and offering to pay cash for the land and making that a summer home or vacation home. Like, that is taking ag land out. And as we lose more ag land, whether it's to development or second homes or solar production or anything else, it's raising questions in a lot of places. How much farmland do we want? How many farmers do we want? How much of our own food do we want to produce? And how do we get it to people? And so someone earlier this week said that you know, this continues to be a time of great change. And whether it's the pandemic or the environment or longer lifespans and fewer children. There's just so many factors that are changing that we live at this time where the world could look very different. And so I think it's fun to ask and pontificate about these questions, but the answers out of context always sound crazy.
Well, we won't take them out of context then. Let's present today's conversation in a concise way. I'm going to end in my comments and flip that switch and from idealist to cynic and say that our listeners have heard both of us talking about how we want to see small operations, small growers and farmers succeed. And I've made it no secret that one of my driving or compelling career objectives has been, why can't we be small and successful? Why can't this greenhouse operation be small and in a single family unit and be profitable? Why is it that many of our growers and farmers are doing what they're passionate about, but they can't afford to do it because they can't make an honest living with it? So I'm going to end there. It's a cynical comment, but it's also couched in a lot of optimism that I think that we can control destinies and reshape our models with help from people like you that view things differently and you know, again, help the farmer and the greenhouse operator understand some of these bigger concepts.
Well, this was a fun discussion. Thanks for following me down all the rabbit holes. And until next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and The Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@strataderm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.